Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm good, Robert. I'm glad you're back.
I'm glad I'm back, too. And I thought you did a really good job on the show last week. I was really excited to hear about it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I learned a lot. It was very
good. That was the goal.
I feel like if we listen to enough Jasmine podcasts, we could all be lawyers.
Maybe. I don't know.
Anyways, I thought it was good. I got a lot of compliments on it, so I hope everybody's not too disappointed. I'm back this week. But this week we have a really special show. Talk to us about what's on the show this week, Jasmine.
All right. Representative Mackenzie Cantrell is a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives from District 38, which is in Southwest Jefferson County, and she is here with us today. Her district runs from basically the Bullitt County line north to Churchill Downs through the area of town around Iroquois Park. Representative Cantrell is an alum of Emerge Kentucky and was elected for her first term this past November. She works at the Kentucky Equal Justice Center as an employment law attorney, and we're super happy to welcome her on My Old Kentucky Podcast. So, Representative Cantrell, as a bit of your background, you defeated an incumbent House member, Denny Butler, in your election to the House. Representative Butler switched parties from Democrat to Republican after the election of Governor Matt Bevin. When the opportunity for a Democrat to run in your district arrived, what made you decide to run?
Well, first of all, hello, Robert. Yes. And Jasmine. Thank you for having me on today. Yeah, this is my first podcast ever, so
we're honored.
You all get to claim that title for posterity's sake. I'm really happy to be on here just to talk about a lot of different issues around my election last year, my first session in the General Assembly. But, you know, for background, I'd always sort of considered running for office, but in my community in Beachmont, where I live, had always been proudly represented by Democrats. But growing up, I think it was really my grandmother who sort of put the bug in my ear about running for office. After she retired from 40 years working in a factory without a college education, she sort of took a second act in public service and actually served on the board of aldermen in the small town where I grew up, and actually even became the mayor for a while. So I always grew up really admiring her leadership and commitment to public service. As for the timing of my particular run for office, you know, there's never a good time to run for office, and there's never a good time for a woman to run for office in particular, because it's such an all-encompassing experience. You know, I'd actually already applied for Emerge Kentucky right when former Representative Butler switched parties. You know, that decision really came as a shock to me. It was a really undemocratic thing to do. He has deep family ties into Democratic politics in Kentucky, with that district having performed very strongly in past elections for Democrats. Mm-hmm. So it was really that, his decision to do that, that really, really struck me at the core the most. But I also had to be prepared to run for office, too.
Right.
I talk about, when I speak to groups about running for office, I talk about two big things that I think can hinder women from running for office, but it can also help prepare women to run for office. So I think you need two things. One thing is to feel confident that you're going to be able to do the job that you're asking people to vote for you for. I had that experience already in Frankfort advocating for employment legislation for low-income workers through my work at KEJC. So I felt pretty comfortable having navigated state politics for a little while, advocated for legislation, really got up there and realized that your state representatives are the people that you see in Kroger every day. They're the ones who really you should feel really connected to, the people who are really there to serve your community. And then there's the other side of things, where you're going to have to win an election to serve in public office. So you have to be really ready to navigate the politics and to run an effective campaign. And that, for me, came through what you already mentioned with Emerge Kentucky. It not only provides you with the nuts and bolts of training of knocking on doors and fundraising and communicating with voters, but also provides you with a very strong and supportive network of women across the state. So that's sort of how things got started. I campaigned all of last year. I had a primary against Councilman Dan Johnson, who I think we all know has been in the news recently.
Well, we're very glad that you decided to run. Your district was one of the districts that seems like it may have had what people call a Trump effect, where there are former blue-collar Democrats that voted straight ticket Republican in the election. However, unlike many candidates, you still managed to win your election. What do you think about this phenomenon? What did you do to overcome it? I mean, this consumed so many other House Democrats. What did you do to overcome that?
So I had one of the more high-profile House races last year, and a race that a lot of people at the time thought was going to be the race that decided which party controlled the House of Representatives. It was a race that saw a lot of money being dumped in it. I had a televised debate on CN2 at the time, which is now Spectrum News, on Nick Storm's show, and tons of other intrigue. So I ended up winning by 259 votes and just finished my first legislative session. And, you know, I actually don't know how many people voted straight ticket Republican in the community I represent, but I do know that in general it was a phenomenon across the state. Hillary Clinton did win the district that I represent, but not by a huge margin, and probably not by the margins that President Obama won in 2008 and 2012. Right. So at least anecdotally, what I can say about that is that there are also was countered by a lot of straight ticket Democratic voters in that area as well. Yeah. I'm not sure how those numbers compare to previous elections, but I'll leave that to the, yeah. I know, Robert, you're a big data and analytics person. Yeah, so I'll let you report on that at some point.
Your district has a very interesting North and South divide, I think, with, I guess, probably 264, 265 as the dividing line, maybe. I'm not sure. But it is the fact that your opponent won every district south of a certain line and you won every district north of a certain line.
Well, and I also live in the northern part of the district as well.
That helps.
And the southern part of the district is less populated.
Right.
So you do see that divide when you look at the numbers, but it's also that's my community, mm-hmm. and in the Beachmont neighborhood and then all around Iroquois Park. So
is Vietnam Kitchen in your district?
Oh, of course it is. Yes. Yeah. All right. We should be podcasting from there, of course.
I would do that for sure.
So while you were running, Democrats did have a slim majority in the House. And like you mentioned, people thought that maybe this race was going to be the one to decide who had the majority. But it didn't turn out that way. And now the Republicans have a significant advantage. How did your first session that just wrapped up, how did that differ from your expectations that you had while you were running?
Well, I have to admit that, you know, I really did want to be a part of holding a Democratic majority in the House, and went into the election with really high hopes that we would do that, just because we had a history of controlling that chamber for so many years. And yeah, I felt that way, you know, because I'd worked so hard over the course of last year to earn the respect of voters and people in my community, but also because of the severe policy implications that control of the House by Republicans, I felt, meant at the time, but also we have seen take place since Republicans have taken complete control of our government.
Sure.
That's really where the change in expectations came. You know, I was really put into check by about 7:30 on November 8th. Mm-hmm. That was really when it was decided that Speaker Stumbo had lost, and that this we are looking at a Republican takeover. The good thing about my job before and my advocacy with KUJC is that I'd really been dialed in on state politics and policy issues. So because I had a good grasp of what was going on and what policies were coming, I was ready to shift my expectations into holding on issues versus opposing legislation like Right to Work and the repeal of prevailing wage in a way that really told the story of my community and the hardworking individuals who have benefited from union membership and high wages. You know, that really became a part of my mission as a new legislator was, you know, I'm going to have to be someone who really stands up and fights against those things, because that's what my community needs me to be right now. It's really difficult to explain and communicate to you all how hard it was those first few days to take some of the most important votes I'll probably ever take in my legislative career on the second day that I was there. Right. And to advocate against policies like Right to Work and prevailing wage in my job before I started in the legislature, and then to have this great honor of being able to earn the respect of my community and be able to influence policy directly as a legislator, only to essentially watch everything that I cared about burn to the ground. And not only that, for that to be the first thing that Republicans wanted to attack,
right,
when they took control.
There was no warm-up act.
No, really wasn't.
And that kind of leads me into the next question. We talked to Representative Attica Scott at the beginning of the session, And she talked to us about the breakneck pace at which the GOP operated and said that that made it difficult for her and other freshmen to get oriented. Tell us about your experience. Did you have a chance to catch your breath? I mean, you said you had to make those very important votes in those first couple of days. Did you have, you know, a chance to meet your colleagues, build relationships with other legislators and that kind of thing?
Well, I did get to build a good relationship with my freshman class because we actually had a 3-day new member orientation with the Legislative Research Commission. So it wasn't as political. I mean, we all knew who each other were and why we were there.
Right.
And there were 28 of us new House members, and there were 23 new Republicans and 5 new Democrats. But we did get to meet each other and talk to each other, and we all shared that same experience of having run an election, having won an election. And we were still in that period where it was still fun, where we hadn't really had been put to the test yet. So there was that. We did get to meet each other. But if you look at the speed of the first 5 days and then some moments after that.
The last few days. Right.
And the middle with the charter schools debate.
Sure.
You know, it's really difficult when you're trying to pass the entire conservative agenda in 30 days.
Yeah. Opening up the budget and everything else. So
it was quite an adventure.
Right.
So I think even if you look at veteran legislators who were there, I'm not sure if you discussed this with Representative Jenkins when she was on the show as well. It was really difficult to get oriented. And to me, part of that, especially those first 5 days, was intentional. Mm-hmm. Because that first few days previously had been designed as sort of a planning period where you get your committee assignments and get oriented. And with the new leadership, we actually had to, House leadership, when it was in Democrat hands, was on the third floor. Mm-hmm. And then Republicans were on the fourth floor. We had to switch those. And they told us that we were going to be switching offices in between the first week and the break. So after the first few days, and then when we got back in February, we would have offices and we would have everything set up. Well, that's that environment of moving and having everybody's offices packed up and not being able to access. I didn't have my legislative aide at the time. I wasn't able to access my constituent contacts. That sort of environment is not conducive to taking the biggest votes of your career. I think that GOP leadership could have better prepared people, could have prepared LRC better for saying, you know, we're going to be doing some big deal stuff that first week.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and get the offices moved. Let's get people
right,
set
that
up.
That seems like something you'd be able to figure out beforehand, but I don't know.
But it was intentional.
Right.
You know, they were really trying to hold their caucus together because they relied on some of their own members. They knew some of their own members were going to defect on right to work and prevailing wage. And they needed to hold together so they could get it passed because, you know, this is what the governor wanted and what the governor had promised everyone since even he had been elected.
Right. The Republicans had been promising it for years. The Chamber of Commerce had been chief of their things to get done since, you know, the early 90s, I think, right to work especially.
So I didn't complain so much about, I knew this was coming. I'm not sure that I prepared for us to go in on a Saturday and really finish it out that first week. But I didn't complain as much about the pace because, you know, I'm ready to step up and do whatever I need to serve my district. You know, if you told me we were going to go 24 straight hours and we were going to pass bills, I'd be there.
Right.
But really what it turned into was a lot of late nights, reading bills, talking on the phone. And really the people who really missed out in the process was advocates and then sort of the public at large who is keyed into a few issues, but, you know, really has to have them brought to their attention, has to read the paper and have noticed that these issues are coming to the floor. These people were really disadvantaged because, and I'll just give the example of the charter schools debate where you have, you know, the meeting notice 12 hours before the meeting occurs. There was only so many ways that you can repeal right to work and make Kentucky a right to work state. There's a lot of different ways you can do charter schools.
Right.
And a lot of different ways other states have done charter schools. And there were a lot of ways that Kentucky could have done charter schools just with the bills that were pending in the session. There were rumors flying around about what parts of whose bill were included. And then there was a last minute committee substitute. And, you know, I'm not on the education committee. So I never even saw what we were supposed to be voting on until we got to the floor of the House the day we voted on it. And luckily, you know, that debate lasted long enough where I was able to read the entire bill and come up with the objections and make a clear and conscientious vote. But that's a really good example of a piece of legislation that could have been made a lot better with public input. It was just not available just because our governor was just so eager to push it through.
Yeah, one of the things that really stuck out to me in that whole debate was so many Democrats were asking the questions about how this was be funded to no answer whatsoever. And they waited until the bill was actually passed and then opened the budget to do the funding bill. So it was like, hey, we don't really know how to even do this if we don't have funding for it. And then they had funding for it, but it wasn't until the bill was actually already passed.
Right. And that came from the Senate. And I found out that it was coming over to the House on Twitter the night that we did it. I mean,
wow. I mean, if you're trying to build a system and you're trying to get public input, you need to know the whole plan put together without, you know, two different bills, which were completely separate from one another. And one was even introduced before the first one was passed, when they're completely together like that.
And I'm really proud of my colleagues for sticking together on the charter schools bill because these weren't knee-jerk reactions. I think these are very legitimate concerns about the process that was taken to get us to the point where we did, but also the piece of legislation itself. There were concerns that it was basically a form piece of legislation, model piece of legislation that wasn't a good fit for Kentucky. And Kentucky really missed a big opportunity with charter schools. You know, we can debate. I don't know if I ever would have been for charter schools, but there are legitimate pros and cons and successes that other states have had. And we really had an opportunity to piece together the best pieces that they have done in other states. But the best pieces, you know, don't line the pockets of, you know, the cronies of the governor.
Well,
so
if you look at the different tacks that were taken between the charter school bill and then SB2, which also related to education, which I think you voted for and I think basically everybody voted for.
Yes.
You know, those were completely different strategies that were undertaken, and I think they're really emblematic of ways to do legislation. So you have
Senate Bill 2 was a very deliberate process.
Yeah, and that was completely led by the GOP, and it got a lot of Democratic votes, which is to say, I mean, that to me tells me that the Democratic caucus is willing to work with the Republicans as long as they receive some input and can help to build the legislation. I mean, not on every issue, obviously. At least on some, I mean, important issues like education, you know, it's not like it's impossible for you guys to work together, but if the tactic is to just kind of ram stuff through without knowing what it looks like ahead of time, it doesn't seem like that's gonna create a great working environment for you or your colleagues.
And more importantly, it's not going to create good policy, which is what the people who we serve have to deal with. This is parents, this is teachers, this is children on our education front.
Yes, that is more important. And yes, you're right. Okay, so we've talked about you on the show before several times. We talked about you before you won, and then we talked about you as somebody we were really excited about joining the legislature after you won. And then we've talked about you throughout the session. And the time I remember most vividly talking about you was the discussion around HB 14, which is the Blue Lives Matter bill. So to remind everybody, this law makes it a hate crime, is a law now, and it makes it a hate crime to commit violent acts against police officers. So Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and other liberal groups, they lobbied very heavily against this bill. And you voted for the bill in the Judiciary Committee and were criticized very harshly by liberal activists. And then you voted against the bill on the floor. You know, and we tried to have a discussion around that, and Jasmine and I, you know, we try to be pretty nuanced about it and kind of understand where you were thinking, but now we have you as a captive audience to talk to us a little bit about your process here. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, what was your rationale for voting for the bill in the committee, and do you regret that at all?
So I actually didn't know about your all show while I was going through the General Assembly in this year's session. And I actually sort of like binge listened to the show after it was over. And I really wish that I had known about the show at the time to listen to what you all had to say and some of the topics that you went through pretty thoroughly and thoughtfully. But when it comes to House Bill 14, you know, I released a statement at the time after the vote, after I started receiving some feedback from mostly people on social media and then some people in the district as well. And that pretty much explained some of my feelings about the bill And, you know, some of those are still true today, even though I did end up voting against it on the floor. I also had some amendments that I filed on the bill that were designed to address some issues that came up in my election last year around something called the CLEP Fund. I don't know if you all have ever discussed the CLEP Fund before. But the CLEP Fund is a police incentive pay training fund that comes from a surcharge off of your insurance premiums that you pay on your homeowner's insurance, for example. That became a big issue in my election last year running against former Representative Butler. He requested an audit of the fund. He claimed it was one of the reasons that he switched parties, that there was corruption going on in this fund.
We have talked about this before.
Oh, okay.
Just very briefly. It was just when the audit was released.
When I was getting feedback from people about my vote in judiciary, and I didn't file the amendments until after the Judiciary Committee meeting because a lot of Democratic amendments to bills were stripped in committee subs, so I kind of had to keep it under wraps that I was planning to file these amendments. But when I started receiving feedback, it was, you know, this bill doesn't need to be about making attacks on police a hate crime. It needs to be more, if we're going to do something to help police officers and their relationship to the communities where they serve, we really need to focus on paying them better, making sure that they're trained appropriately on issues dealing with the communities that they serve. And that's what the amendments that I filed were really addressed to do. And then I supported Representative Scott's amendment on it as well, which would have basically studied the issue before implementing the bill fully. So I think my goal in it, in voting for it, was if I can make this bill better by addressing some of the issues that came out in my district that a lot of people are concerned about around the CLEP Fund, the structure of it, the funding mechanism and that led to the audit in the first place, and then open the door for some new incentive pay money for officers, that it would be a better bill and at least a little bit more palatable than what it was at the time.
That makes a lot of sense. So it's kind of a trade-off almost. If they're going to pass this, which it seems like there wasn't anything standing in its way, and you know the Republican legislature is going to pass this, but if you could get some nice stuff attached to it, from a political standpoint, it seems like you were trying to get some stuff that you supported into a bill that was going to pass regardless.
And actually, that CLEP Fund bill was a standalone bill sponsored by, the primary sponsor was a Republican member, and it actually didn't get through this time. That I feel like that was really our chance to really make a difference for the way that we treat and train and pay police officers. That was really just lost for divisive political reasons.
Right. So given that explanation, I remember the aftermath of your committee vote, and there was some really kind of inappropriate feedback that you received, absolutely, which I sir was not very much fun and makes me glad I'm not a public servant a lot of the times. But there were some people that I really respected that were really disappointed. And kind of talk to us about, you know, when this type of situation occurs as a public servant and as a legislature, what are the steps that you take with those people to kind of like try to build back those relationships or mend those fences?
I think you're right. I think it was a tough moment for me personally, but I'm sort of a glass half full type of person. I've really been happy with what this situation has said about me and the type of person that I want to be as a legislator. So the good thing is that I evolved. I did something that probably not a lot of my colleagues would have done, which is I think a lot of people would have just stuck with the vote that they made and been a little bit stubborn about it and not listened to a lot of the noise around it at the time. But I really took this as an opportunity to be who I am, which is open and engaging, the kind of person who says yes to every meeting, every interview. You know, these are the first public comments I've made about this vote, but I knew you were going to ask about it. I didn't shy away from it. I want to do everything I can because that's the kind of representative I want to be. I want to represent everyone fairly. I want to know all the information that's out there before I take a really tough vote. And that's what I did in this situation. I called back everyone who called me that day. I didn't respond a lot on Facebook just because it was just very tense at the moment. But I did, if I was able to figure out who the person was on the voter, on our voter registration database or something like that. I did reach out to them and did call them. I answered every email. That's something that I do. I did during the session was we go in earlier on Fridays and I sort of sit down Friday afternoon and my legislative office and answer a lot of the emails that came through. So I tried to handle this as fairly as I could, and I did get some showing of support for the vote as well. I don't think the FOP was happy with the amendments I filed on the bill. I made no one happy with this bill. I mean, let's be honest. But there were certain individuals who reached out to me and said, you know, it's not the end of the world. It's gonna be okay. You did what you thought was best at the time, but now you're listening to people and you've done the best you could. And I think that's what we all do. That's what we all strive to do. So that's what it really showed me, was to stay engaged, be who you are, be honest with people, and you'll be fine.
Well, thank you so much for discussing that issue. I know it's kind of a tense one, and we really value having that discussion.
Yeah.
So we'll leave that there, and we'll talk a little bit about your day job, I guess, with the Kentucky Equal Justice Center. Before we talk too much about that, can you just tell us a little bit about the KEJC and like what it is and what it does?
Yeah, I definitely planned on doing that because a lot of people don't know about us. So I call us KEJC, and that stands for Kentucky Equal Justice Center. Kentucky Equal Justice Center is a nonprofit legal services an advocacy center. So we actually provide direct legal services to low-income people and also do some advocacy. And the reason that we're able to do that is because in a sense, you can think of us as a traditional civil legal aid program because we represent low-income people. We have income guidelines and we do civil cases as opposed to sort of like what you do, Jasmine, at the public defender's office, which is in criminal cases. The difference between like sort of like the Legal Aid Society of Louisville and KEJC is that we're privately funded. Mm-hmm. We do not receive that what's called LSC or Legal Services Corporation money. And what that means is we're free. We're free to do things that LSC funded programs are not. And those few things are representing people in class actions, collecting fees, representing undocumented persons, and lobbying. And we do a little bit of a mix of all of those. We have the Maxwell Street Legal Clinic, which is an immigration law program in Lexington.
Jasmine and I both lived really close to there.
Right,
we
did.
At points, yes.
So you went to UK, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Very close to UK. Yeah. That is very well known in Lexington. And a lot of people don't know that, you know, Maxwell Street is KEJC. KEJC is Maxwell Street, or however you want to say it. But we also have three or four other staff attorney programs. And my program is it's called the Workers' Rights Project. So I'll tell you, my job's evolved, obviously, since I've been elected. But before, it was sort of a four-part job. Advocacy at the state and local level around policies for workers, and especially the low income. And then community education, so getting out in the community and giving presentations on rights and responsibilities in the workplace. So, because if you think about it, some people have to learn the hard way about what the workplace is like, and some people can't afford to learn the hard way of what the workplace is like. So I give presentations to Kentucky Refugee Ministries, for example, with their refugee program. So people who are new to the United States, telling them what the world of work in the United States is like.
Americana would be in your district too, right?
I live very close to Americana. I would say technically, I don't have that side of Southside Drive until you get to what's called Steedley Drive, which is where the Kentucky Humane Society is actually. Okay. So technically that's in Representative Donahue's district, okay. But I have a very close relationship with the people there, and it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's a wonderful asset to the Beachmont community. Mm-hmm. So that's a very poignant example of a type of group that I would talk to about what it's like in the workplace. We talk about the minimum wage and overtime and what discrimination in the workplace means and what it can look like. Really give people an idea of how they might be exploited and try to help them prevent that and have that on their mind. And then the other part of it is obviously I do a little bit of litigation. Mm-hmm. I do a lot more of that now because I'm actually work part-time now for KEJC. So I sort of had to take the policy advocacy. I get enough of that now. So that part of my job has fallen by the wayside and fortunately fallen to someone else. So now I really am focusing on community education and litigation. And we try to do some coalition building around working with different groups and being sure that we're working together effectively with labor unions, for example, mm-hmm. who are working for different types of clients, but we're all working for the same shared goal.
Sure. So we actually had Kara Stewart on the show to talk about healthcare, who is one of your colleagues.
I listened, of course.
Yes. Yeah. And so it was great to hear from her to talk a little bit about healthcare. And you just described in detail that your work with KEJC is more focused on labor.
Yes. We're multidisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So we have health, consumer, employment, and immigration. And then we have some people who actually work in outreach and enrolling people in healthcare and do a little bit more than the policy.
Right.
To provide that sort of direct services element.
Well, this was quite the legislative session for labor issues. And so kind of talk to us a little bit about how the repeal of the prevailing wage and the implementation of right to work impact the people that you see on a day-to-day basis in your job.
So I represent non-union employees. I focus my practice in wage and hour. I'm not sure if I talked about that. My job's privately funded by a foundation in Washington, D.C. The heart of that project is to remedy wage violations. With representing non-union workers,
sure.
Union workers are fortunate enough and have the ability to work through their union when something like this is happening to them, where they think they're not earning what they were promised or they're facing some sort of discipline mm-hmm. that they didn't expect or they think they're not being followed by the collective bargaining agreement. You know, non-union employees don't have those kinds of protections. So it's really just whatever's guaranteed by state and federal law. So in that respect, the mechanism for relief is not the same for a union worker versus a non-union worker. But what we know about right to work is that it affects all employees, that all wages go down in right to work states versus free bargaining states. And we also know that workplaces are not as safe in right to work states as they are in free bargaining states, because another element, another layer of what unions provide to the members that they serve is training. Unions are able to build a good relationship with the employers they have to make sure that workplaces are safer,
right.
And that people are treated fairly with the wages and benefits that they receive. So in a way, with me not representing union workers, I think the ability of everyone to become a union member in this state is now weakened
right.
by right to work and prevailing wage.
So it just makes it so that your work is probably more impactful because there's all of a sudden more people that would need the type of services that you might provide.
I don't have a hard time finding people who need our assistance.
Yeah.
It's actually quite overwhelming the need for, and I'm actually one of the only attorneys in the state who focuses in this area for low income people. There are some wage and hour attorneys in the state, and I also speak Spanish, so I tend to represent a lot of the Hispanic community and people who are really, really exploited. And
sure.
I have some cases of human trafficking that have occurred in our state, and a human trafficking law that was passed in 2013 that gives a lot more relief and mm-hmm. damages to human trafficking victims is something that we're trying to leverage for our clients in yeah. the state as well.
There's a very large story about non-English speaking laborers that, you know, walked out of the job at the Omni Hotel just a couple weeks ago. So there you go.
I know. I was there in support and solidarity with those
pictures.
Workers.
I was right down the street, but I didn't go by. Should have, though.
You should have.
Yeah.
It was very early in the morning, and we could have used your podcast voice and spirit
well,
that morning.
We always, whenever we talk about policy, one of the things we always try to do is to give people the opportunity to talk about reforms they really think should happen. You know, there aren't a lot of really good prospects for progressive employment and labor reforms going on in Kentucky, but if there were, what type of changes do you think are really important, and what would you like to see if you could make some changes to the way that Kentucky does employment and labor law?
Well, first of all, let's be real. Like, are these things really progressive? Is the work that I do really progressive? Is making sure that people are paid the money that they were promised and that they're treated fairly in the workplace and in this economy where we all have to work? I'm not sure that I think of these things as being progressive, but I'll tell you about a few of the bills that I filed over the session. One of them was a bill, if you remember, and I don't know if you've all talked about this on the show before, but Louisville passed an ordinance raising its minimum wage within the county, and Lexington did something similar about a year after that. And so we were on a good pace here locally to have a $9 minimum wage. There were some groups who challenged that and went to the Kentucky Supreme Court, and the Kentucky Supreme Court struck the ordinance down. And so now Louisville is back to $7.25 right. for the minimum wage. And what the Supreme Court said in that case was that it just wasn't explicit enough to them in state law that state law pretty much occupied the field in wage and hour, is what they said. So
we did a show on that, and you can listen to it. And if you
want
to know that
was one of our very, very early.
Yeah, it really was. Yes.
Because it probably came out, and I think in the fall of last year, probably around the time that you all would have started the show. And so I filed a bill that would have reversed that decision and made it really clear in wage and hour law that localities can raise their minimum wage, because especially with the urban sort of island that Louisville is, giving a locality, I believe in local control of issues generally anyway, what is right for Jefferson County might not be right for Callaway County, for example. So really giving us the flexibility to control our wages locally, I think, would have been a good thing. I filed a lot of pieces of legislation on employment law this time. I think people say you write what you know. So
right,
that's,
absolutely.
That's sort of what I did. And so I filed a bill also that would have taken domestic and agricultural workers. So we have a lot of agricultural workers in Kentucky. We have a lot of workers who come over from on the H-2A visa program. I think Kentucky's maybe one of the sixth largest states that utilizes that program. And H-2A has regulations that protect a lot of these workers federally. But in general, agricultural and domestic workers are exempt from all wage and hour law and all workers' comp law. So my bill would have folded them into workers' comp and being sure that they're guaranteed the minimum wage. Our legislative session tended to go the other way on that. I think we exempted lawn services employees from workers' comp, and so there really wasn't an appetite to protect more people. It was really to let more people off the hook when it comes to workers' comp and wage and hour law. So that was really frustrating. But for some other reforms I think we could do, one of the issues that I worked on a lot, and Representative Overly filed this bill this time and always had in the past, is independent contractor misclassification. It's something that my organization cares a lot about and that I had worked on in the past. Is basically whether you're a W-2 employee versus a 1099 employee, and people who use 1099 workforces and really cut people out of wage and hour protections, discrimination protections, and a lot of safety protections.
And they have to pay their taxes.
They find that out the hard way a lot of times, or they find out when they're injured on the job or they're laid off and they can't get unemployment insurance coverage. There's a ton of problems with utilizing a workforce that way. So we just need some guidance. Employers need guidance and regulation on that. Probably for some other paid sick days, paid maternity leave. These aren't crazy things. These are things that, you know, a lot of us salaried employees have paid sick days, and everyone gets sick, but not everyone has the time that they need to get better. Right. So that's a really important thing for hourly employees, that they don't lose pay because they're sick, and especially in the food service industry where you don't want someone serving you who's sick.
Sure.
You know, there is a whole scheme of pieces of legislation we could do to make workers' lives better. And it has been one of the most frustrating parts of being in the legislature at this time that we have sort of gone the other direction.
Right.
Not all of us, of course, but that has been the prevailing sentiment among the majority party.
Sure. Yeah, that is the truth. But I mean, I think that you've brought up a lot of really good ideas. And, you know, if people need to know why they should vote for people who look like you or believe like you, there's good reasons to do so. Well, anyways, thank you so much for coming on, Representative Cantrell. It was really nice to have you. So wish you well and good luck with all the interim committees that you have to go to.
Thanks to you both, and thanks for everybody for listening to my first podcast and suffering through it with me together. That's so wonderful.
Okay, well, Jasmine, tell the people how they can find us.
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. You can like our Facebook page. Robert posts our show notes on Medium, so you can check those out. And you can find our podcast on pretty much any podcasting app of your choice.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.